Chapter 10. Mr. Loomis? His stare still waiter than he seemed to brush aside the problem she presented, as beneath his notice. H, certainly. Take the elevator to the second floor. Next aisle to the left. He waved her down the endless perspective of showcases. Anna Lisa followed the line of his lordly gesture, and a swift ascent brought her to a great hall full of the buzzing and booming of thousands of clocks. Whichever way she looked, clocks stretched away from her in glittering interminable vistas. Clocks of all sizes and voices, from the bell-throated giant of the hallway to the chirping dressing table toy. Tall clocks of mahogany and brass with cathedral chimes. Clocks of bronze, glass, porcelain, of every possible size, voice and configuration. And between their serried ranks, along the polished floor of the aisles, moved the languid forms of other gentlemanly floor walkers, waiting for their duties to begin. One of them soon approached, and Anna Lisa repeated a request. He received it affably. Mr. Loomis? Go right down to the office at the other end. He pointed to a kind of box of ground glass and highly polished paneling. As she thanked him, he turned to one of his companions, and said something in which he caught the name of Mr. Loomis, and which was received with an appreciative chuckle. She suspected herself of being the object of the pleasantry, and straightened her thin shoulders under her mantle. The door of the office stood open, and within sat a gray-bearded man at a desk. He looked up kindly, and again she asked for Mr. Loomis. I'm Mr. Loomis. What can I do for you? He was much less portentous than the others, though she guessed him to be above them in authority, and encouraged by his tone she seated herself on the edge of the chair he waved her to. I hope you'll excuse my troubling you, sir. I came to ask if you could tell me anything about Mr. Herman Ramey. He was employed here in the clock department 2 or 3 years ago. Mr. Loomis showed no recognition of the name. Ramey? When was he discharged? I don't fairly know. He was very sick, and when he got well his place had been filled. He married my sister last October and they went to St. Louis. I ain't had any news of them for over 2 months, and she's my only sister, and I'm most crazy worrying about her. I see. Mr. Loomis reflected. In what capacity was Ramey employed here? He asked after a moment. He told us that he was one of the heads of the clock department, and Lisa stammered, overswept by a sudden doubt. That was probably a slight exaggeration. But I can tell you about him by referring to our books. The name again? Ramey, Herman Ramey. There ensued a long silence, broken only by the flutter of leaves as Mr. Loomis turned over his ledgers. Presently he looked up, keeping his finger between the pages. Here it is, Herman Ramey. He was one of our ordinary workmen, and left us 3 years and a half ago last June. On account of sickness? Anna Lisa faltered. Mr. Loomis appeared to hesitate. Then he said, colon, I see no mention of sickness. Anna Lisa felt his compassionate eyes on her again. Perhaps I'd better tell you the truth. He was discharged for drug taking. A capable workman, but we couldn't keep him straight. I'm sorry to have to tell you this, but it seems fairer, since you say you're anxious about your sister. The polished sides of the office vanished from Anna Lisa's sight, and the cackle of the innumerable clocks came to her like the yell of waves in a storm. She tried to speak but could not, tried to get to her feet, but the floor was gone. I'm very sorry, Mr. Loomis repeated, closing the ledger. Remember the man perfectly now. He used to disappear every now and then, and turn up again in a state that made him useless for days. As she listened, Anna Lisa recalled the day when he had come on Mr. Ramey sitting in abject dejection behind his counter. She saw again the blurred unrecognizing eyes he had raised to her, the layer of dust over everything in the shop, and the green bronze clock in the window representing a Newfoundland dog with his paw on the book. She stood up slowly. Thank you. I'm sorry to have troubled you. It was no trouble. You say Remy married your sister last October?
Yes, sir. And they went to St. Louis right afterward.
I don't know how to find her. I thought maybe somebody here might know about him.
Well, possibly some of the workmen might.
Leave me your name, and I'll send you word if I get on his track.
He handed her a pencil, and she wrote down her address. Then she walked away blindly between the clocks.
Zai, Mr. Loomis, true to his word, wrote a few days later that he had inquired in vain in the workshop for any news of Remy. And as she folded this letter and laid it between the leaves of her Bible, Anne Eliza felt that her last hope was gone. Miss Mellins, of course, had long since suggested the mediation of the police, and cited from her favorite literature convincing instances of the supernatural ability of the Pinkerton detective. But Mr. Hawkins, when called in counsel, dashed this project by remarking that detectives cost something like $20 a day, and a vague fear of the law, some half-formed vision of Evelina in the clutch of a blue-coated Pfizer, kept Ann Eliza from invoking the aid of the police. After the arrival of Mr. Loomis's note, the weeks followed each other uneventfully. Ann Eliza's cough clung to her till late in the spring, the reflection in her looking glass grew more bent and meager, and her forehead sloped back farther toward the twist of hair that was fastened above her parting by a comb of black India rubber. Toward spring, a lady who was expecting a baby took up her abode at the Mendoza Family Hotel, and through the friendly intervention of Miss Mellins, the making of some of the baby clothes was entrusted to Ann Eliza. This eased her of anxiety for the immediate future, but she had to rouse herself to feel any sense of relief. Her personal welfare was what least concerned her. Sometimes she thought of giving up the shop altogether, and only the fear that, if she changed her address, Evelina might not be able to find her, kept her from carrying out this plan. Since she had lost her last hope of tracing her sister, all the activities of her lonely imagination had been concentrated on the possibility of Evelina's coming back to her. The discovery of Remy's secret filled her with dreadful fears. In the solitude of the shop and the back room, she was tortured by vague pictures of Evelina's sufferings. What horrors might not be hidden beneath her silence? Ann Eliza's great dread was that Miss Mellins should worm out of her what she had learned from Mr. Loomis. She was sure Miss Mellins must have abominable things to tell about drug fiends, things she did not have the strength to hear. Drug fiend, the very word was satanic. She could hear Miss Mellins roll it on her tongue. But Ann Eliza's own imagination, left to itself, had begun to people the long hours with evil visions. Sometimes, in the night, she thought she heard herself called. The voice was her sister's, but faint with a nameless terror. Her most peaceful moments were those in which she managed to convince herself that Evelina was dead. She thought of her then, mournfully but more calmly, as thrust away under the neglected mound of some unknown cemetery, where no headstone marked her name, no mourner with flowers for another grave paused in pity to lay a blossom on hers. But this vision did not often give Ann Eliza its negative relief, and always, beneath its hazy lines, lurked the dark conviction that Evelina was alive, in misery and longing for her. So the summer wore on. Ann Eliza was conscious that Mrs. Hawkins and Miss Mellins were watching her with affectionate anxiety, but the knowledge brought no comfort. She no longer cared what they felt or thought about her. Her grief lay far beyond touch of human healing, and after a while she became aware that they knew they could not help her. They still came in as often as their busy lives permitted, but their visits grew shorter, and Mrs. Hawkins always brought Arthur or the baby, so that there should be something to talk about, and someone whom she could scold. The autumn came, and the winter. Business had fallen off again, and but few purchasers came to the little shop in the basement. In January, Ann Eliza pawned her mother's cashmere scarf, her mosaic brooch, and the rosewood, what not on which the clock had always stood. She would have sold the bedstead too, but for the persistent vision of Evelina returning weak and weary, and not knowing where to lay her head.
The winter passed in its turn, and March reappeared with its galaxies of yellow jonquils at the windy street corners, reminding Ann Eliza of the spring day when Evelina had come home with a bunch of jonquils in her hand. In spite of the flowers which lent such a premature brightness to the streets, the month was fierce and stormy, and Ann Eliza could get no warmth into her bones. Nevertheless, she was insensibly beginning to take up the healing routine of life. Little by little, as he had grown used to being alone, as he had begun to take a languid interest in the one or two new purchasers the season had brought, and though the thought of Evelina was as poignant as ever, it was less persistently in the foreground of her mind. Late one afternoon she was sitting behind the counter, wrapped in her shawl, and wondering how soon she might draw down the blinds and retreat into the comparative coziness of the back room. She was not thinking of anything in particular, except perhaps in a hazy way of the lady with the puffed sleeves, who after her long eclipse had reappeared the day before in sleeves of a new cut, and bought some tape and needles. The lady still wore mourning, but she was evidently lightening it, and Ann Eliza saw in this the hope of future orders. The lady had left the shop about an hour before, walking away with her graceful step toward Fifth Avenue. As he had wished Ann Eliza good day in her usual affable way, and Ann Eliza thought how odd it was that they should have been acquainted so long, and yet that she should not know the lady's name. From this consideration her mind wandered to the cut of the lady's new sleeves, and she was vexed with herself for not having noted it more carefully. She felt Miss Mellins might have liked to know about it. Ann Eliza's powers of observation had never been as keen as Evelina's, when the latter was not too self-absorbed to exert them. As Miss Mellins always said, Evelina could take patterns with her eyes. She could have cut that new sleeve out of a folded newspaper in a trice. Musing on these things, Ann Eliza wished the lady would come back and give her another look at the sleeve. It was not unlikely that she might pass that way, for she certainly lived in, or about the square. Suddenly Ann Eliza remarked a small neat handkerchief on the counter. It must have dropped from the lady's purse, and she would probably come back to get it. Ann Eliza, pleased at the idea, sat on behind the counter and watched the darkening street. She always lit the gas as late as possible, keeping the box of matches at her elbow, so that if anyone came she could apply a quick flame to the gas jet. At length through the deepening dusk she distinguished a slim dark figure coming down the steps to the shop. With a little warmth of pleasure about her heart she reached up to light the gas. "Do believe I'll ask her name this time," she thought. She raised the flame to its full height, and saw her sister standing in the door. There she was at last, the poor pale shade of Evelina, her thin face blanched of its faint pink, the stiff ripples gone from her hair, and a mantle shabbier than Ann Eliza's drawn about her narrow shoulders. The glare of the gas beat full on her as she stood and looked at Ann Eliza. "Sister, oh, Evelina, I knowed you'd come." Ann Eliza had caught her close with a long moan of triumph. Vague words poured from her as she laid her cheek against Evelina's trivial inarticulate endearments caught from Mrs. Hawkins' long discourses to her baby. For a while Evelina let herself be passively held, then she drew back from her sister's clasp and looked about the shop. "I'm dead tired. Ain't there any fire?" she asked. "Of course there is." Ann Eliza, holding her hand fast, drew her into the back room. She did not want to ask any questions yet. She simply wanted to feel the emptiness of the room brim full again by the one presence that was warmth and light to her. She knelt down before the grate, scraped some bits of coal and kindling from the bottom of the coal scuttle, and drew one of the rocking chairs up to the weak flame. "Here that'll blaze up in a minute," she said. She pressed Evelina down on the faded cushions of the rocking chair, and, kneeling beside her, began to rub her hands. "You're stone cold, ain't you? Just sit still, and warm yourself, while I run and get the kettle. I've got something you always used to fancy for supper." She laid her hand on Evelina's shoulder. "Aunt Taco, don't talk yet," she implored. She wanted to keep that one frail second of happiness between herself and what she knew must come. Evelina, without a word, bent over the fire, stretching her thin hands to the blaze, and watching Annalisa fill the kettle and set the supper table. Her gaze at the dreamy fixity of a half-awakened child's. Annalisa, with a smile of triumph, brought a slice of custard pie from the cupboard and put it by her sister's plate. You do like that, don't you? Miss Mellon sent it down to me this morning. She had her aunt from Brooklyn to dinner. Ain't it funny it just so happened? I ain't hungry, said Evelina, rising to approach the table. She sat down in her usual place, looked about her with the same wondering stare, and then, as of old, poured herself out the first cup of tea. Where's the what not gone to? She suddenly asked. Annalisa set down the teapot and rose to get a spoon from the cupboard. With her back to the room, she said, colon the what not? Why, you see, dearie, living here all alone by myself, it only made one more thing to dust, so I sold it. Evelina's eyes were still traveling about the familiar room. Though it was against all the traditions of the Bunner family to Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.